Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dori Smith. This is the first in our series on accountability, global efforts to prevent war crimes and repressive policies during a decade of war and occupation in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine. During the Vietnam War, philosophers Bertrand Russell and Jean-Paul Chartres held a tribunal to establish war crimes being committed in Indochina. The results were profound and lasting and created a record by which to judge the actions of the U.S. military in Indochina. There have been other tribunals since on Latin America and more recently on Iraq and Afghanistan. On March 4th, the Russell Tribunal on Palestine opened in Barcelona, Spain.
A réaffirmé la primauté du droit international comme base du règlement du conflit israélien.
Stefan Hessel welcomed the tribunal members to session.
Sur la Palestine, vise à réaffirmer la primauté du droit international comme base du règlement du conflit israélo-palestinien.
He is saying, ladies and gentlemen, the Russell Tribunal on Palestine seeks to reaffirm the primacy of international law as the basis for settling the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which has been going on for many years. The occupation of their land is the main obstacle to the recognition of the legal rights of the Palestinian people and consequently to a just and lasting peace in the Middle East. Stefan Hessel fought with the French army and the resistance during World War II. He was imprisoned in the Nazi concentration camp at Buchenwald, and after the war, he served as a French and UN diplomat. In 2006, Stefan Hessel was named a Grand Officer of the Legion of Honor. Ken Coates was an organizer and co-chair of the first Russell Tribunal on Vietnam. He's a British politician, anti-nuclear activist, and writer, as well as the chair of the Bertrand Russell Peace Foundation. In Barcelona, he described the impact of the first Russell Tribunal.
The findings of the tribunal were published right across the world, and they made a notable contribution to the development of public opposition to the war. It became impossible to ignore the atrocities which marked that conflict. And it can be said that the tribunal made an important contribution to allowing the plight of the Vietnamese people, in Russell's words, to be presented to the conscience of mankind. Subsequently, a second tribunal was constituted to examine repressions in Latin America. This was initiated by Lelio Basso and Russell's widow, Edith. Edith extended the initial invitations to those who agreed to serve in the investigations. After three sessions, a permanent people's tribunal was established.
Ken Coates also quoted Bertrand Russell, saying, while they lacked force majeure, standing to enforce their findings on war crimes in Vietnam, they nevertheless had an advantage. They were completely free to document violations of international law and convey them to the people of the world, educating and stimulating work toward accountability. In the same way, the Russell Tribunal on Palestine released its findings to the world. They're open source and available online in video and text at russelltribunalonpalestine.org.
The tribunal really is a call from civil society towards ending Israel impunity in the Israel-Palestine conflict, but also towards exposing the support that Israel receives from third parties such as, you know, European states or the US or bodies such as the UN or the EU. We really wanted to focus actually on third parties' violations, so states that enable Israel to actually violate international law and do what it does in Palestine. So the first session was held in Barcelona at the beginning of this month and really focused on who gives the weapon to Israel. So if Israel like had a gun and killed a Palestinian, our goal was to expose who gives the gun to Israel and who allows Israel to actually buy the gun and the bullets and to get away with it. Since Barcelona, we've really tried to have a very legal process, which means that we couldn't really get attacked, because if you base your work on international law, Geneva Convention, international jurisdiction, it's very hard for your enemies, in brackets, to actually attack you. So The conclusions of the tribunal are legally based. I'm just talking about UN Geneva Conventions, international jurisdictions, and many various aspects of international law, asking actually states, instead of just issuing statements and condemning the building of settlements, condemning the blockade of Gaza, to actually take action to stop the violations by Israel. So since Barcelona, we've a group of delegations from the tribunal met with the EU Commission in Brussels. They also met with the parliament, like Spanish parliament in Spain, and we organizing now meetings in the UK as well with MPs, MEPs, etc., to present our report and our findings.
In 2010, the Tribunal on Palestine has a distinct advantage over the earlier one on Vietnam in that it reinforces official ongoing efforts to hold Israel to the same standards of international law that other countries must adhere to. According to UN investigation team leader on Gaza, Judge Richard Goldstone, Israel has in fact been trying to get international law changed to accommodate them. At a speech at Yale University February 2nd, he said Israel is trying to have laws on proportionality changed. They have to do with the rationale for attacks that kill civilians.
The present government of Israel claims that the international laws of armed conflict should be changed to allow disproportionate military responses in order to attack terrorist groups. This should not be regarded as a plea by Israel for the right to take measures in self-defense. For that is not seriously denied Israel. It should also not be regarded as a plea for the right to take military measures against members of terror groups responsible for such attacks. It can logically only be interpreted as a plea for the right to take measures that are regarded as unlawful under present rules of international law. No reason has been proffered to support that claim. And I would suggest there is not one. From recent media reports in Israel, it would appear that leaders of the Israel Defense Force have come to recognize that the suggested changes to which they've referred in international law are not going to happen. And clearly they can't happen without a wide consensus of the international community. Let me return to where I started. The laws relating to armed conflict requiring proportionality with regard to military action. That means that the number of civilians who stand to be killed or injured by an attack must be justifiable, having regard to the military advantage to be gained by the action. Thus, for instance, if there are three or four terrorists firing rockets from the roof of a hospital containing hundreds of patients, it would not be justifiable or lawful under the rules of law, as I understand them, to bomb the hospital complex. Action taken to take out the terrorist that would cause the death or injury of a small number of civilian patients may well be justified, depending on the danger caused by the attacks from the hospital and the military advantage in bringing that to an end. The former, bombing the whole complex, would be a war crime. The latter would not. These, as I've already indicated, are difficult decisions, and especially in what has been aptly called the fog of war. That is why, as I mentioned earlier, the laws grant a margin of appreciation in favor of military commanders who take such decisions. I do not propose this evening to discuss the findings of the UN fact-finding mission on Gaza, and will content myself by saying that both Israel and Hamas were found to have launched attacks against civilians in Israel and in Gaza in a manner that constituted war crimes and possibly crimes against humanity. I would emphasize only that there was certainly no denial of Israel's right to defend its citizens from unlawful attacks. Indeed, the criticisms of Israel in the report were based on the lack of proportionality, which assumes a right to take military action.
Justice Richard Goldstone is former chief prosecutor of the UN International Criminal Tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and later inquiry into Kosovo. The Israeli rights group B'Tselem documented three Israeli civilians killed by Qassem rockets during the Gaza war, six members of the security forces, and four soldiers killed by Israeli-friendly fire. They found 1,387 Palestinian deaths, the majority, 773, non-combatants, 248 police who were also not engaging in hostilities. They said 36 were unknown. The Palestinian Human Rights Organization said 1,434 Palestinians were killed, 1,199 of them civilians, with 235 of them combatants. The BBC reported over 5,000 Palestinians wounded. But Palestinians are still dying from unexploded ordnance, Israeli weapons used in Operation Cast Lead. The UN Mine Action Team has recovered 340 unexploded Israeli bombs and shells, including 84 white phosphorus shells in Gaza. The bombs have killed 10 Gazans in the year since the war. We asked Frank Barat to talk about the fact that America supplied the white phosphorus and other munitions used against hospitals, clinics, and even a UN compound in Gaza.
This is sort of blatant breach of international law. And by being complicit to what is a war crime, you know, the use of white phosphorus, not prohibited during times of war, but it's prohibited to use white phosphorus in civilian areas. And that's, you know, Gaza is only a civilian area. Gaza is a tiny strip, you know, with 1.5 million people living in this really tiny piece of land. So Israel, by using white phosphorus during this assault on Gaza, was clearly in breach of international law and actually committed war crime, which has been reported, you know, many times over in either the Goldstone report, the Dugard report, even Human Rights Watch had a report on this. So by providing such a weapon and knowing that it was going to be used during a war, the U.S. is itself also in breach of international law and in breach of very important conventions. So that's really what we wanted to expose. And we had Colonel Desmond Travers, who was part of the Goldstone delegation, who is a weapon expert himself, that gave a very damning report on the use of such prohibited weapons and the impact they had on the health and on the civilian population.
Talk about the testimony of your munitions expert, the man who served on Judge Richard Goldstone's UN investigating team into Gaza.
Colonel Desmond Travers, who is an Irish retired colonel now specializing in weapons and in weapons used during times of war, gave a really chilling presentation in Barcelona because he thinks that all weapons such as phosphorus and dime bombs, etc., should be banned from countries' military arsenal. So he said it's not about not using these bombs on civilians, etc. Those bombs are so dangerous that they should be banned altogether from any military arsenal. Again, we had Desmond Travers, but we also had Derek Sommerfield, who is a health specialist from the UK, saying that what happened during the Gaza war was that Palestinian paramedics were confronted with burns and injuries that they've never seen before. And a lot of lives could have been saved if actually they knew what caused those injuries. For example, white phosphorus, you cannot extinguish the fire. The more air it receives, you know, the flame starts again. If you put water on it, the flame starts again. So people were severely burned, and the medics, the paramedics, couldn't really do anything about it because they didn't know what had caused such injuries. So Colonel Desmond Travers made a point on all those weapons. It's not about, oh, the U.S. is using them, the U.K. is using them, France is using them, Israel can use them. No, it's about they should be completely banned altogether because the goal of those weapons is actually to target civilians. And you cannot avoid civilians with white phosphorus or with dime bombs or with flechette bombs. So if targeting civilians is actually called terrorism, you know, we're just confronted right now with state terrorism.
And again, nothing that Hamas or anyone else in the region would have done would have justified the use of this white phosphorus.
No, obviously not. Because once more, if you use white phosphorus, you know that you cannot avoid killing or injuring civilians. And under international law, targeting civilians is considered as terrorism. So, you know, if you want to be on the good side of on the right side of the law, you cannot use, even if Hamas uses rockets, you actually, again, the rhetoric about defending itself against Israel, Hamas use of rockets. Okay, Israel, obviously the right to self-defense, even if, in my opinion, what happened during the Gaza massacre was obviously not self-defense, but yes, Israel has the right to self-defense, but there is a case of proportionality as well. You cannot use Hamas rockets or the Palestinian group rockets. I've killed, I think, about 10 people in the last 8 years. Israel in 22 days has killed 1,400 people, so it's obviously completely disproportionate. Disproportion could be considered as a breach of international law, and that's clearly you need to react in a proportionate way. But again, as far as I'm concerned, it's not about disproportion or proportion. It's about Israel occupying Palestine. As long as Israel occupies the West Bank and Gaza, Israel actually, you know, cannot ask Palestinians to respect and not to be violent. The day Israel withdraws from the border, the 67 borders, and, you know, open Gaza borders and stop the blockade, then if at this point, you know, Hamas continues sending rockets, etc., then, yeah, Israel will probably have a case for it. But before this, no, Israel has a lot of work to do.
You're listening to Talk Nation Radio, a special on accountability for Israel with Frank Barat, coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, russelltribunalonpalestine.net. We also wanted to take a moment to update you on U.S. citizen and former Yale professor Mazen B. Kumsaya, who was threatened, or as he put it, harassed by Israelis as he made his way home to Palestine recently. Kumsaya was participating in a peaceful protest over land and Israeli settlements just prior to Easter, when Israeli soldiers abruptly fired concussion grenades into the peaceful crowd. They broke the windshield of the professor's car, but he is okay.
What did he do? What did he do? Shame on you. Shame on you. What did he do?
At an earlier protest at Anabi Sela, March 19th, ISM volunteer Ellen Stark was shot at point-blank range with a rubber bullet as she was standing with medics. 25 people were arrested, including the co-founder of the International Solidarity Movement, Huwaida Araf. She was arrested while negotiating with soldiers to allow Ellen Stark to get through the military line to the hospital. Frank Barat said he's seen this type of treatment of Palestinian protesters by Israel.
If anything like this was happening in the Western world, people would be shocked and there'll be, you know, people taking the streets. You know, I've been to demonstrations in Palestine and it's always been peaceful. I mean, it can only be peaceful anyway. There's like 150 Palestinians, international and Israelis, actually, for example, in Bilayin, just, you know, walking towards the wall, or actually it's a fence in Bilayin, which takes actually more land than a wall will, but let's call it the fence, then a huge fence, you know, chanting slogans, you know, for their freedom, for their right to go and pick their olive groves, etc. And in front of them, you've got about 20 to 30 Israeli soldiers armed to the teeth with rubber bullets. Again, they're rubber bullets only by the name, because it's actually a big metal ball with a very thin coat of rubber around it, and tear gas, and often there's been real ammunition used as well. So the demonstration are completely mashed down, really, by the Israeli army. It's frightening. You know, people get arrested, people get beaten up, people get put in jail for no reason, really. Like some people in Berlin. Most of the time, also, it's the leaders of sort of the village committee or the leaders of civil society resistance are being taken. You know, the Israeli army's got invade their houses, smash everything into the house. Obviously, the kids are scared to death. The women are sort of pushed to the ground. And the male are taken out to jail and put into administrative detention, which means you pretty much have no rights whatsoever. It's like being in Guantanamo or in Abu Ghraib. You can't see a lawyer. You never even tell what you've been arrested for. And it's happening to, like, you know, hundreds and hundreds of Palestinians all the time. And again, this is never reported in the mainstream media. You know, there is, like, images and realities in Israel-Palestine, and most of the thing you see is actually images, it's not the reality. So by exposing this sort of disinformation, we want to show the people that what's happening in Israel-Palestine is not the most complicated conflict of all times, a 3,000-years-old battle between Jews and Muslims that hate each other. It's not also a humanitarian conflict that a lot of people now want to portray this as a humanitarian crisis. And we want to show that it's entirely political, that it could be solved very easily on political terms, that actually most of the international community, actually about 95% of the international community, agrees on the settlement of what should be the solution. Every year, the United Nations General Assembly votes on peaceful resolution to the question of Palestine, which implies Israel withdrawing to the 67 borders or the 49 armistice line, you know, fair settlement of the refugee question and Jerusalem as a shared capital. And the vote is overwhelmingly for this solution. The vote is like 164, 7 abstention and like 3 against. And you know, the countries against are always the US, Israel, actually Australia, and a few Pacific islands, which shows that, you know, the international community agrees on a very simple, politically based and, you know, legally based solution. And the only countries that actually don't agree, and so you could say are not for peace, Israel, the US, and Australia is backing this all the time. And to change this, there is like sort of the pro-Palestinian or the pro-justice movement really work with international law. And what's the right of the Palestinian people, right of self-determination, right of movement, the right of education. And you find more and more than the pro-Israel movement or the pro-Zionist movement, you know, they've got really little facts left to hold on. So they go back to, yeah, it's 3,000 years old, it's based on the Bible, etc. So you've got really two major differences here. And you see it in debates. You see it like when people, you know, like Noam Chomsky, Norman Finkelstein give talks, for example, in universities. The questions from the pro-Israel or pro-Zionist movement, direct attacks, but the facts have sort of disappeared. They don't have any ground to work with anymore. That's where we have, I mean, international civil society and solidarity movements have really to reframe the conflict completely. Even the use of the word conflict is sort of misleading as well, because it sort of implies, and the way it's reported in the States emphasizes, that it's a conflict between Jews and Muslims, and a conflict could mean equal share of two power fighting each other, which is obviously not the case. So we always go back to Hamas. When you talk to the Israeli government now, it's pro-Israeli groups, they always go to Hamas. But the simple fact, Hamas was founded in 1988 and really became prominent only sort of in the beginning of mid-90s. But the occupation started in 67 after the Six Days War. So the occupation started 20 years before Hamas was created and started like 30 years before Hamas actually became prominent. And if you go back to 48, it's obviously 40 or 50 years since the dispossessing of the Palestinian people happened. So the fact that the media always portray this as a rocket was launched into Israel and Israel retaliated, in the U.S. even more, Israel always retaliates. You know, Israel never attacks. I mean, the army is called Israel Defense Forces. They defend themselves. They defend themselves against the surrounding Arab countries, etc. If you look at the facts again, and that's what we ask people to do, look at the facts. How many times Israel has really been attacked and how many times Israel has attacked neighboring countries? And it's overwhelmingly Israel has been proactive and attacking countries. So actually the army could be called Israel Offense Forces instead of Defense Forces. And the fact that also to remind people that, okay, rockets are launched from Hamas, or actually other Palestinian groups like the Al-Aqsa Brigade or the Islamic Jihad, etc., they launch into Israel. But the point is the occupation. You cannot ask, in a way, people to stop resisting as long as there's an occupation in place. And Gaza gets bombed pretty much daily because people, we've seen in the media in December 2008, January 2009, how incredible, like, and how overwhelmingly Israel was ready to attack Gaza. But it's happening every day. You know, fishermen can't go fishing without being shot at. There's F-16 flying over Gaza pretty much on a daily or weekly basis. People getting killed, tunnels getting bombed with, you know, people inside. So it's a continuing process. And it's very important to remind people that it's very much a process. It's not just one event every 6 months. It's a continuing sort of assault on the population of Gaza, which has really nothing to do with rockets. And we could, if we had been more time, we could talk about the wall as well. Israel always claims the wall is for security. But again, looking at the facts, if the wall was for security, firstly, the wall has not been completely built yet. The wall, I think, in total should be about 700 kilometers, and only 560 kilometers have been built, which means there's still 140 kilometers where Palestinians can pretty much enter Israel, not at will, because it's difficult, but they can if they want. And also, the wall, by grabbing about 12% of West Bank land, leaves about 150,000 Palestinians on the Israeli side of the wall, which means that the security issues sort of fall on its head. If you want to actually build a wall because you're scared that Palestinians are going to bomb Israel, put all the Palestinians beyond the wall. Don't leave 150,000 on your side of the border. So the wall is clearly a land grab and is there to make any two-state solution pretty much impossible. But that's, again, a thing that you never hear in the mainstream media. And if only you were looking at the facts, so if the media was doing its job properly, it would become pretty quickly obvious to the public that what's happening there is clearly a violation of international law and the rest.
What about the tribunal's findings on the settlements, Israel, now in East Jerusalem, evicting Palestinians for Jewish-only homes?
Which is also under international law a war crime. Israel is still considered as an occupying power, actually, in the West Bank and in Gaza, because even if Israel claims that he left Gaza in 2005, Israel still controls the access, you know, the air, the land, and the sea. So Israel is clearly still under international law, and it's been repeated many times by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, so very respected human rights and aid organizations. As an occupying power, and Israel cannot move, you know, population into occupied territories, what it does all the time by building settlements and giving people incentive to actually move to the settlements. And Israel, of course, cannot take the people that it occupies, cannot kick them out of the land. And that's what Israel is doing constantly. And it came more to the fore in the last few weeks with the East Jerusalem settlement sort of fiasco when Joe Biden visited the Middle East. And on the day he was in Israel, the interior minister announced that 1,600 houses were going to be built in East Jerusalem. And it shows again that Israel's sort of laughs at the face of pretty much, you know, the whole international community and even its masters, its wrath master, the U.S., really. And I'm not sure what we're seeing now, you know, the sort of rift or so-called rift between the U.S. and Israel. I'm not sure how real it is. But I think that we might see here the beginning of a little crack in the Israel-U.S. relation, which has been the main problem, really. I mean, the U.S. veto about anything concerning or criticizing Israel has been the main problem for more than 40 years now. And maybe there is a little crack here that people should use, really.
And the Russell Tribunal on Palestine also focusing on what the EU has or has not done.
It's been quite hard to actually pin down where the violations of the EU, because if you hear the statement of the EU commissioner, of the EU parliament, it's always good. You know, the statements are always, the settlements are illegal. Israel has to recognize that Jerusalem is a shared capital. So the statement's always good, but there's never any action. And the EU could take very simple actions to push Israel to respect international law. And in fact, the EU, instead of sort of condemning Israel and punishing Israel, the EU sort of reward Israel. There's the EU-Israel Association Agreement, which gives Israel privileges in tax terms, etc., and in trade terms as a European country. The EU-Israel Association Agreement is being put forward more and more by, for example, the Spanish government really wants this agreement to come into place soon. Something like this will never happen to any other country. A country that has just bombed a small strip of land to pieces, killed 1,400 inhabitants, bombed schools, mosques, UN compounds building. And you've got the Western powers pretty much telling them, you know, good, continue. We're giving you reward. You know, I'm going to be able to send your goods to Europe at very favorable tariffs, etc. So the EU is also completely complicit. And even if when you send letters, when you lobby parliament, MEPs or member of parliament, they always tell you, you can look at my records of voting and my statements. And yes, the statements are good again, but there's never any action. And instead of having action condemning Israel, they actually reward Israel. So the EU is clearly in breach of even the Lisbon Treaty, of part of the Geneva Convention, because as signatories of the Geneva Convention, you are obligated to act when a crime is committed. That's why civil society pressure can help change this by just putting pressure on its government.
Frank Berat, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Dori.
Frank Berat is coordinator of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine, russelltribunalonpalestine.net. The tribunal's work is continuing in London as they take on the topic of corporations with Israeli contracts and international law. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut. Our website is talknationradio.org, and we're syndicated weekly with Pacifica Network. Write to us at talknationradio@gmail.com. Our music is by Fritz Heed, fritzheed.com.